How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate you, the public, on genetic and health topics through event coverage, news stories, book movie reviews, and interviews. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, and professors. My guest today is Ira S. Pastor. He is the CEO of BioQuark, a life sciences company developing proprietary combinatorial biologics for the regeneration and repair of human organs and tissues. Ira has over 30 years of pharmaceutical experience. He serves as a board member at multiple companies and organizations, including RegenerAge, the ReAnima Project, the World Academy of Medical Science, and the World Economic Forum's Human Enhancement. So thanks so much for coming on the program and sharing with us today.
Thanks for having me, Kara. I appreciate it.
So I want to start out with what we actually know about regeneration and repair of human organs and tissues.
Sure. So we actually know quite a lot in terms of the fact that we as humans possess minor regenerative capabilities when it comes to the sort of the physiological turnover of the, you know, the obvious tissues, your blood, your epithelial lining of the gut and skin, and so forth. We have a minor hypertrophic regenerative capability in the human liver, which, you know, will increase in size and cell count to sort of take on missing function. And then most importantly, some would point out, we have an excellent regenerative wound healing response. So, you know, we bleed very rapidly as humans and die of loss of blood very rapidly. And so we have a very potent, you know, sort of thrombotic and fibrotic response. As a balance to that, what nature did not give us is the more complex forms of regeneration. So the what is known as the epimorphosis and morpholaxis, which we see in nature. So the spinal cord of the salamander, the head of the planarian worms, the ability to cut a starfish in half and get two starfish. Those things obviously, from an evolutionary perspective, had eluded us. However, you know, there are proxies in humans in regard to this ability to, you know, turn back time and start over. And so, you know, that's been sort of the core of what we've been all about, sort of studying these similarities and how we can, you know, for lack of a better word, sort of reawaken sort of what we lost in terms of our evolutionary past.
Because as you said, some animals can actually regenerate limbs, whereas we're not quite there in terms of what we can naturally do.
Right. And it goes well beyond limbs. You know, you have beyond the spinal cord and the limbs, you have, eyeballs that can be plucked out, large parts of the heart. And maybe what's really less known is the fact that, you know, some species, you know, you can take out a majority of their brain, in some cases, you know, cut the brain out entirely, and it comes back. What is a little less well known, which we find equally fascinating, we spend a lot of time on, is sort of the fascinating ability of the regenerators to sort of shrug cancer off like it was the common cold. And what we're finding, you know, these fascinating experiments that were done back in the 1930s and 1940s, where we were first studying carcinogens, and, you know, you would infect a tank full of frogs with some nasty carcinogen, and they develop tumors. But then they just, you know, disappear in a couple of weeks. And what we're realizing now in 2018 is the same regenerative dynamics that we see in limb regeneration and organ regeneration, you also see in the reversion processes in these species and how they just, you know, they get rid of tissue they don't want and keep the stuff that's good and go on very happy day.
So people might think of, oh, regeneration, like looking at stem cells and things like that. But the research kind of can have impacts beyond that. You're talking about cancer. I mean, that is a huge area of research that doesn't even come to my mind when I think of regeneration research.
Right, and that's a fascinating, you know, regeneration in cancer has always sort of been part of, when you look at it from a stem cell-centric perspective, it's always been part of this double-edged sword, right? You know, you put undifferentiated cells into somebody, and you get teratomas and all sorts of tumor formation, and that's not what you're interested in. But the paradox is that when you look at nature, it's the regenerators that are the most cancer sort of resistant and resilient organisms. And there was a wonderful paper published out of, I think it was Mike Levin's group up at Tufts a few years ago, sort of called Regeneration. You know, is it the cause of cancer or is it actually its cure? And have we overlooked, in our interest in sort of quickly regenerating stuff and pumping cells into people, have we overlooked the underlying dynamic of sort of reprogramming, remodeling, and sort of reorganization of tissues that we see happen so effectively around the natural world? And forgotten, you know, I say you're in Philadelphia. I love to give the example that, you know, University of Pennsylvania 50 years ago down the street here, we first found out that, you know, you could load up an embryo with tons of cancer cells, which is, you know, embryo is also a wonderfully regenerating organism, and the baby is born without cancer. And so we sort of known that these dynamics exist, but we've really never followed up on them in the sort of a translational way before. So, you know, that's what we're hoping to do.
And so looking at this kind of regenerative capabilities in cancer, have you seen that the enzyme telomerase plays a role in this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, telomerase is a key enzyme, not just in the sort of the stabilization of our chromosomes, but also in the sort of regulation or reestablishment of age, or let's say reversal of aging. I mean, the telomerase, when you study the dynamics of, for instance, the age reversal that occurs when, you know, we are first formed in our mother's womb, when the egg and cell and sperm cell first get together, you see the elongation dynamic occurring in the, you know, based on the ooplasm bioactives, but you also see it, of course, in sort of just our natural day-to-day cellular and chromosomal stabilization processes. So it's definitely integrally involved. And we also see telomerase sort of coming to the table in a lot of the induced pluripotent sort of stem cell reprogramming that's happening in the petri dish in the literature. So it is clearly an important piece of the overall puzzle, whether it is a regeneration we're talking about or whether it is aging and those dynamics as sort of a key underlying, let's say, stabilizer of biological function in the cell.
And so does age play kind of a factor in our ability to regenerate as humans? Can kids regenerate a little bit better than the elderly population?
We fall off a cliff at a very young age. All the non-human regenerators can regenerate from their birth to their death perfectly. With us, yes. I mean, we lose a lot of that regenerative capability. And you sometimes, you know, you see it, you know, throughout life, especially later on when you see things like reduction in wound healing capabilities, which is not just a, you know, an exogenous problem, but, you know, sort of the, all the endogenous stuff that bubbles up, whether it's DNA damage, inflammation, inappropriate organelle function, and so forth. Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of interesting cases actually in the literature with regard to sort of brain damage in the very young, where you still see a neurogenic niche existing in very young infants. Something, you know, that's obviously something that we lose quite rapidly with regard to our brains. But yeah, I mean, age in mammals and humans plays an integral role, and unfortunately, it is a major sort of drop off early on in life that we see the loss of it.
And you're the CEO of BioQuark. Can you kind of explain what BioQuark is and what type of research you do?
Absolutely. So we are, you know, we define ourselves as a biopharmaceutical company, and we are primarily focused on developing biologics that can mimic many of the dynamics that we see in things like regenerative systems, limbs, major organs and tissues, and at the same time are very active in the study of the early age reset processes that we find. And a lot of our program focuses on ooplasm research, so the biomolecular milieu that you find in oocytes or eggs, because that is really the sort of the queen cell that leads to everything else, whether it's, you know, the 200 different cell types that we ultimately become, or even the stem cells. This ability to sort of take what was old DNA, what have you, and turn it back in time and start it on its journey in terms of embryogenesis, morphogenesis, and so forth. So we are very interested in studying those dynamics and ultimately how we develop not stem cell products, but biologics instead. So how we capture the most important sort of bioactive substances that we see in neoplasm and create therapeutics that, instead of just, you know, creating cells in a petri dish, which have limitations, actually create drugs that can stimulate this type of regeneration and remodeling in vivo. And that's our ultimate goal.
So you're looking at kind of how naturally humans have these capabilities and looking at the start of, you know, from an egg to a human and seeing if you can capture some of that abilities into drugs.
Exactly. Because that, you know, our genome from the very beginning, once again, you know, has seen these types of bioactive substances. The moment we're formed, our genome is sort of taken over by this sort of biochemical bath of substances that guides it forward for its next 9-month journey. So our genome, whether it's the individual genome or the 50 trillion that we become, knows, sort of communicates with these substances. So we think it's a much more, as you said, natural approach to sort of dealing with how you create a therapeutic intervention as opposed to, you know, just a traditional new chemical entity that the body's never seen.
And we've talked about cancer a little bit. What other types of conditions and diseases could potentially benefit from this type of research?
Well, we are very active in all sorts of degenerative and repair situations. So whether it's diseases with an underlying cellular degeneration component, your Alzheimer's, your congestive heart failure, Parkinson's, type 1 diabetes, or whether it's underlying cellular damage where, you know, you don't want a regenerative event, you want to reorganization events, so your autoimmune diseases, your chronic inflammatory diseases, your fibrotic disorders, all of this sort of falls into our basket. We are very focused on neurology at this point in time, just because of, you know, I know, you know, a lot of people will debate whether, you know, heart disease and cancer still takes precedent, but I think a lot of people will tell you today and in the coming 10 to 20 years, if you're not focused on neuroregeneration and with, you know, the wave of Alzheimer's that's approaching, you're missing a big piece of what the future is about in terms of unmet medical needs.
Certainly. We've had a couple, patient advocates on the show and other researchers that are focused on neurodegenerative conditions, and it's definitely heartbreaking conditions to see. And so research in this area is very promising and hopeful to see if we can really not only have treatments, but ultimately cures.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's why we're kind of excited on our own Alzheimer's research, not just because we are a regeneration company and obviously focused on the end stage of the problem. But at the same time, you know, we're beginning to realize, not to, you know, put the nail in the coffin for beta amyloid, but, you know, there's been just so many failures with that sort of singular approach. And we're just realizing nowadays that there's just so much more going on upstream in terms of inflammatory, metabolic component, you know, the classification, you know, this type 3 diabetes. There's just so much more biologically, metabolically occurring upstream that we're not focusing on. So we think, you know, we're happy that we're going to be able to have an impact, not just at the end of the problem, but earlier on. So we're kind of excited.
And so with that, you're kind of looking at earlier kind of stages or in the process of these diseases, because it kind of makes sense. If you're looking and targeting at an earlier point, that you may be able to prevent a little bit more symptoms and damage from occurring.
Right. As with any disease, you know, Alzheimer's is an example. This doesn't fall out of the sky. I mean, it's something that develops over time. And this, you know, this is one of the discussions that we always have. You know, you're not just constant. You're not getting sick. It's not a linear thing, right? I mean, your body is constantly you're getting sick, but your natural sort of cellular competition, cellular reversion events on a daily basis are keeping you healthy. And so, you know, it's this cycle. If we can emulate what we see and then nudge sort of the developing disease state back further in time, We win on both fronts. And, you know, I point out, you know, even during the course of this 30-minute conversation, you know, you and I are, you know, we're fighting all sorts of diseases in the background. I mean, oncogenic transformations in our cells happen every second of the day. But it's our internal reversion systems, cellular competition systems, that keep everything in check and keep us healthy for so many decades. So if we can intervene there as well, we're doing much more of a service than just, you know, trying to rescue something at the very end of the process.
And so while you're researching all of this, how much are you focused on genetics and identifying maybe certain genes that play roles or kind of the epigenetics that are occurring?
We're much more focused on the epigenetics than we are the genetics for these chronic degenerative diseases. And the primary reason for that is when you go into the literature, and, you know, and we openly admit, look, we're not the first ones to do this. Regenerative biology had its heyday in the 1940s. A lot of what we are learning is that the genes, you know, you go study the genes of why, you know, a newt is so good at regenerating its limb, and what do you find? You find expression of all sorts of oncogenes. And so, no, you're not just going to genetically engineer, you're not going to put more oncogenes in somebody, because oncogenes, obviously, they're oncogenic, but at the same time, they serve a role, depending on how they're regulated by expression levels, epigenetics, and so forth, in what happens in the regenerative processes. So we want to understand the genetics, but we're not, say, a genetic engineering company that's, you know, is just, hey, let's pump much more of the XYZ gene in because it's hyperregulated in these salamanders over here. No, that's not going to get us where we want to go. So we're much more focused on the higher level control architecture, epigenetics, chromosomal architecture, and actually, more and more lately, the sort of the tissue level dynamics that we're seeing, so the membrane potentials, the forces of mechanotransduction, the shear stresses, genes do one thing, but there are a lot of forces above it in these hierarchies that we just really need to integrate or we miss the big picture.
And it seems like in a lot of research that epigenetics is kind of have more focus even than just genetics, is studying genes, of not just looking at kind of what hardware you have, but the software kind of us, and which genes are being turned on and off, and how they're all kind of interacting.
Absolutely. And not to, you know, jump on the genes back. But yeah, I mean, genes don't do much, right? I mean, they hold information. They tell us how to make RNA, and then RNA tells us how to make amino acids and so forth. But it is a very high vertical architecture of many dynamics. And epigenetics is clearly a very important part. But there's just so much more going on. Just read some fascinating papers recently on sort of the dynamics of the viscoelasticity of the intracellular fluid, and reaction diffusion dynamics, and this water gel ordering, and all. We don't think about this stuff too much because it's more sort of biophysical as opposed to biochemical. But you know, if those things go wrong, and they have nothing to do with genes, but if, those are off slightly, everything downstream of that, whether it's the gene regulatory networks and so forth, are affected. So we like to understand the big picture, and a lot of it is more than just sort of the genes and why we sort of look broadly and think broadly with these programs.
And so one area I kind of want to pick your brain on is that this research that you're doing and that others are also contributing to of regeneration, is this what has allowed scientists to grow organs outside of the body?
No. And, I'm friends with a lot of those people, and I think their work is fascinating. The problem is the regeneration and generation, for that matter, in nature, or whether it's non-human or human embryos that grow, is a bottom-up generative process where we start with one cell and we end up with trillions. Organ bioprinting, or sort of seeding of a scaffolding, is top-down regeneration. It's much more akin to what you would see in human wound healing, where you want to put some cells in and put them on a structure. Unfortunately, a heart, as an example, you take a heart scaffold, you put some cardiomyocytes on it, it beats. But a heart is much more than cardiomyocytes. It's smooth muscle, it's Purkinje fibers, pacemaker cells, and so forth. all acting and operating in sort of, you know, four-dimensional synergy. So definitely there could be interesting components that help guide the differentiation of cells that may be involved in 3D organ printing, but we think that the better way, ultimately, at the end of the day, is not creating entirely new organs. I mean, our goal is to regenerate and repair the ones you have. So, you know, well, I don't want you to have to have a kidney or a liver or a heart transplant if we can repair and regenerate the one you already have in you. It's a little bit of a safer process and ultimately keeps you whole, as opposed to, although people do have futuristic visions of, you know, Kira Dineen having her, you know, 10 hearts somewhere sitting on the side there for when you need them. We think the bottom-up process makes a lot more sense in the short term.
It kind of makes sense that if you're looking kind of at an old car, it's kind of easier to repair the engine than just get a whole new one. It's a little bit of a maybe faster process, right? And maybe, hopefully, I would think less expensive, but that might be a little bit far in the future.
Yeah. You know, that's a wonderful example. And just, you know, too often we make the analogy in this business of us, you know, human beings being cars. And I always say, you know what? Cars have 30,000 parts. Human beings have 50 trillion.
A little bit more complex.
Each of 25,000 protein coding genes executing 100,000 reactions per hour. A little different. So we want to stay away from that analogy as much as possible.
And so are there any clinical trials currently being used from regenerative disease, or is that a little bit also kind of in the future?
Well, our U.S. program is still 3 years out, and there we're focusing on kidney regeneration. We have some non-RX work going on in the area of skin care in terms of, and that's more of a, that's sort of the fast-moving consumer packaged goods business. But we do have some initial non-U.S. partnerships where we are working with some hospitals and clinics abroad trying to sort of expedite some of the sort of the phase one work, and specifically in the area of spinal cord injury. And here, you know, while we are a U.S. company and we are focused on the United States, very interested in the market, today, obviously, all the smart people tell you that, look, this isn't like the 1980s where you just sort of ignored the rest of the world. And when you have, you know, Harvard Medical School operating in Dubai and, you know, Cornell operating in Qatar, and you really see the sort of globalization of medical research now. So we have to be abroad as well as only at our home base. So we're beginning to get our feet wet in spinal cord injury research in Asia right now.
Very interesting. Wow. So another area of research that I wanted to talk about a little bit is somatic reversion. So can you kind of explain like what this term means for someone that maybe doesn't know a lot about the specifics of biology behind it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's been one of those areas where, you know, you see the common thinking is that when you come to these sort of 6,000 to 8,000 rare genetic diseases that affect hundreds of millions of people, that this is sort of the playground of, you know, genetic therapy and gene editing and so forth. However, you know, what we completely overlook, although it's been a very well-known concept, documented well in the literature for decades now, is the whole concept that when we have a genetic disease of some type with a certain mutation, all 50 trillion cells in our body are not affected. We, on all of these genetic diseases, are, we like to say, mosaics. We are mixtures of sick, damaged cells. We are also some healthy cells. Now, people say, well, why is this? Well, the reason for this is during your journey from the one cell zygote to the several trillion cell baby that is born, although you may inherit a gene, a mutation, certain events such as intergenic recombination, point shift mutations, second site suppressor mutations occur, and normal cells are produced in the developing embryo. You actually even see this in chromosomal disorders. You have sort of non-homologous segregation, and you have correction of, you know, Down syndrome, and you see mixtures of different cell types. So you see this, and you primarily see it in diseases where there's a regenerative physiological turnover, skin, blood, connective tissues. So, you know, you think of diseases like Bloom syndrome, X-linked SCID, epidermolysis bullosa. These are all conditions where you actually visibly can see the mosaic situation occurring, where you have normal cells that are corrected naturally and those which are still diseased. Now, when you dive deep into the literature, you find out that mosaicism exists across all tissues, but the ones that don't turn over, your lungs, your brain, your other parts, you're not going to see them bubble to the top like you do in sort of these rapidly regenerating tissues. So we are very interested as a company, and we started looking at some of this only at the in vitro scale right now, and we have some Down syndrome and cystic fibrosis cell lines, on how we can actually stimulate the regenerative turnover in our non-regenerating tissues where you may have a mosaic situation where we could, for instance, stimulate the situation of cellular competition for healthy cells to outcompete those that are damaged. And we think, you know, not to say anything bad about genetic engineering or CRISPR, I know the exciting stuff that's in the news nowadays, but when it comes to engineering somebody who is, you know, 50 trillion cells, and you might have to target tens of billions of them with genetic modification, there may be a backdoor process where we don't have to focus on the gene itself, but only on the cellular competition dynamic and how we can stimulate and push in a certain direction the ability of those healthy cells to outcompete those that are mutated. And this may be an entirely new direction as an alternative to things like CRISPR that we are interested in working on. This is much earlier stage than our other work, but nonetheless, it's important, sort of, in our opinion, that the community, the advocates, people out there know that these biological natural gene correction dynamics occur, and we've known about them for decades.
So it's very interesting that it really differs, as you said, from other gene therapies such as CRISPR that's really been a buzzword the last few years. And this really is a whole different kind of approach where you're using a natural process that we do as humans, but kind of just kind of pushing it a little bit to maybe work a little bit better for those that have diseases, to kind of have the kind of sick cells, the ones that have a bad mutation, to kind of die off compared to cells that don't have that same mutation.
Exactly. You hit it on the head. And this is, once again, if you go into the literature and you look at sort of the cellular competition research that has been done the last, say, 10, 15 years, it's really a fascinating area. I mean, you just don't realize how much, you know, we're sitting here with our 50 trillion cells, just how many battles are naturally just going on behind the scenes where, you know, healthy, you know, what they're referred to as sort of hyper competitors outcompete those that are weaker. And this is not just genetic or chromosomal problems, it's just any genetic modification where you have these two populations. So you see, you know, a lot of the research focuses on cancer mutations, but clearly with everything you look at with regard to somatic mosaicism, it's going on everywhere. And so if we can control this, it may offer a very, you know, so much more natural and cost effective, you know, I'm talking about, you know, $1 million in injection type thing, alternative to the gene editing stuff. So we're interested in progressing with it.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. For those that want to kind of learn more about it, again, the concept is called somatic reversion. That about wraps up today's episode of DNA Today. I want to thank you so much, Ira, for teaching us all about this regeneration and repair of human organs and tissues and kind of expanding our perspective on this.
I really appreciate having you on the show, Kira. It was a great time.
And for those that want to learn more about his company, BioQuark, you can go to bioquark.com, on Facebook at BioQuark. And if you're interested in learning more about the show and listening to all the episodes, you can go to dnapodcast.com, on Twitter at dnapodcast, Instagram's a little different at dnaradio. And any questions for myself and Ira can be sent to info@dnapodcast.com. Questions for him, I'll forward on, as he's the expert in this area. So thanks for listening, and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you. We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.